It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us listen for the right voices. There are so many voices around and within us, it's hard to know which ones to listen to. The strong and loud voices are voices of authority, voices of power, telling us who to be and what to do, expecting obedience. These voices come from everywhere. From political and military war cries to voices of some of the worst religious leaders echoing the screams for war, or voices of friends who are too certain to be right. Jesus was right when he said the road that leads to the loss of our souls is broad and many take it. But there are always other voices as well, the still small voices of those better angels of our nature who counsel us toward compassion and justice. This is the narrow path that leads to our more authentic soul and a compassionate world. And few follow the narrow path. Let us be among those on the narrow road to understanding rather than condemnation, love rather than bigotry or hate. Those voices of the better angels of our nature who call us are few in number. But let us listen to them and let us join them. Let us, too, become the angels of our better nature. Amen. The purpose of this series of animal story sermons is to make two points. One is that we can find a profound, deep, true, and adequate story of who we are by understanding where we came from as parts of nature. That the story of life going back 4 billion years can be a more profound story than we've been taught in our culture to understand who we are. The second point is that it is also an adequate story for understanding how we should live. What's our nature and how should we live to fulfill it? How should we act toward others? How should we act toward the future, that we can find these profoundly religious questions answered through the story of life, the evolutionary story of life, and our relationships with other animals. Some of it comes from things as simple as noticing that as sciences have progressed and DNA evidence is saying, my gosh, we share something like 98.4% of our DNA with chimpanzees and bonobos. Don't you think we must have something in common with them? And other comes from meticulous observations of animal behavior, especially in the past 30 years or so, where it's really turned a corner, where we can simply describe some behavior so clearly you don't even need to make an argument. And we can see examples of profound empathy, caring, compassion in other animals, even extending across species. And we know because we react emotionally to the stories when we hear them, we know that's because that's in us too. So the obvious question this all raises is why, if we are so damn perfect, is the world in such a mess? And why, if we have everything in us we know, do we keep asking, as we have for all of human history, who am I and how should I live? This week and next week, I want to look at this question of what keeps us from becoming what we could be from a couple different angles. And today I want to go back first to some of the roots of our empathy to understand what empathy is. What's it mean when you can feel and sense what another being feels and wants? And we can all do that. So can our family pets. So can lots of animals. You think your dog doesn't understand your moods? But the roots of empathy are like a double-edged sword. And they give us both our greatest possibility and our greatest danger. So I want to talk about that today and see if I can persuade you, or if not persuade you, at least get you thinking about things in a different way. What it's saying from a religious standpoint is that we are born both good and evil. We are capable of being either a brave blessing or a cowardly curse, or just an indifferent presence. We're capable of every bit of this. We know all this stuff. Not all of it may be good, but all of it is natural, and all of it has very deep roots. One of the things that can either help us or hurt us is the effect of the cultures that we have created, the human cultures. A couple centuries ago, the philosopher Rousseau said that we're born good and pure, but culture makes us bad. I'm not saying that. I'm saying we're born with the whole range of possibilities, good and pure and really awful, able to be very selfish, very destructive, able not to care at all, able to do harm to others without even feeling it, and able to feel it poignantly and able to want to act on the behalf of the weakest. All of it is in us. But I'm also saying that culture often seems to strengthen the worst of our abilities rather than the best. Last week I talked about the experiment in which humans were asked to watch pictures of faces, human faces with different emotional expressions, anger, fear, so on and so forth. It was an interesting experiment because they didn't know they were seeing faces. They were done subliminally. The images were only on a few milliseconds, and the people being tested weren't even aware that they'd seen any faces or expressions at all. Nevertheless, the wires to their face muscles, I don't think I want to see how they did this, registered that their own face muscles mirrored the expression they saw instantly. This is an emotional basis of empathy, saying that something in us instantly mirrors the look and the expression and some of the emotion that we've seen. That's how deep-wired we are to notice and to care about others and about what they feel. We're social animals, though, which means that we don't do this in isolation. Much of who we are is a social identity. And the social identity comes from being welcomed into the group rather than shut out of it. And so here's the problem. We care what others think. We'd like to be welcomed in. We would all like to fit in. In order to fit in, we usually need to go along, to conform. And we care so much about what others think of us and about fitting in, we can often, and history shows we have often, sunk down to low levels of empathy and become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. We can go either way. It's a catch-22. There are lots of stories showing how deeply we are wired not only to care about what others feel and think, but to be influenced by them before we even think about it. And so I don't want to bring you stories from near animals where you might think, well, we're just imagining that chimpanzees feel like we do. I want to bring you stories from animals so far removed from us in evolution, you can't even imagine a connection to see that how deep this runs. Guppies, for instance. I want to talk about guppies. In a great experiment, replicated a bunch of times, in a great experiment with guppies, this is on the I'll have what she's having theme. Now you have to picture these tanks. Some of the fun is setting up the experiments and inventing them. They have two small fish tanks side by side, and there's a board between them, so the fish in one can't see the fish in the other. And you have, let's say, we'll just have the tanks. A tank is here, and a tank is here, and the board is here, and you're facing them. Guppy number one, female. Guppy number two, female. They take two males and put them in with guppy number one. You can call them bachelor number one and bachelor number two. They leave them in here, and by golly, this guppy prefers bachelor number one. Now they take them out, which doesn't seem fair. They take the board out from between the two aquariums, and they put these same two bachelors in the second tank. And this guppy, who's never seen them before and never saw what happened in the first tank, she likes bachelor number two instead. Did I have that straight? Good. But the first guppy's watching this and watching the second guppy choose the one she hadn't liked. Now they take them back out of number twos, put the same two males back in with the first guppy, and by gosh, she prefers bachelor number two. She'll have what she's having, and it trumps what she had chosen on her own. That's fairly good. I have no idea what happened to those guppies after that experiment. I hope somebody got the bachelors. Similar experiment. Another animal, wildly separated from us evolutionarily. 100 million years and more. Octopuses. Two Italian scientists trained. You wonder how they think of these things. Was it a slow day in Naples? What? Same setup, two tanks, an octopus in each one, and a wall between them that they can put in or take out. And with the wall in, they train this octopus over here to attack. They have red balls and white balls, and they train it to attack only the red balls. I don't know what they have against red balls, but that's what it is. After they've got the octopus trained, they take the board out, and now they let this other octopus watch this. And they'll keep putting in red and white balls in the tank, and by golly, this octopus attacks the red one every time. And the first octopus is right up against the glass watching this. Now they put the red and white ball in the other tank. It attacks only the red ball every time. We'll have what she's having. It's important to realize that the guppy, the first guppy, and the octopus weren't right. They were certain, but they weren't right. They really don't know which is the better mate or which is the better enemy. They're just certain that this is the one they're going to choose. And so they do it, and their certainty and their behavior seems to convince the one next to them to imitate them. We imitate. We want to fit in. We want what's been established. This isn't news to any of you. You know the saying, monkey see, monkey do. And when we use it for people, what we really mean is, you know, when people imitate something they've seen, then they're acting like monkeys. They're acting like something far less advanced than us, because people don't do that. Well, this is what makes scientists so excited to invent experiments, to see if we do. Back in the 1930s, there was a famous experiment of a family, the first family that I know of, that tried to raise a chimpanzee baby along with their human baby at the same time in their house. The family was named the Kelloggs. And the idea in the experiment, and you can see this coming, all of it, was that since monkey see, monkey do, the little chimp will want to imitate the higher animal. That means their son. And so by raising them together, you can kind of help the chimp take a big leap along the evolutionary ladder by imitating a human son instead. That was the theory. They had to cancel this experiment because they found before long that their son was starting to act like a chimpanzee. Their son was making pant hoots and eating with his fingers and making sounds just exactly like a chimpanzee. And at every mealtime, they were on the verge of having two chimps at the table. The fact is, we ape apes better than apes ape us. We ape better than anybody. We can imitate anything better than any other animal. Human see, human do. This carries over in so many ways. There was an experiment done with other animals, this time human animals, a complicated experiment. And sometimes when they make up complicated experiments, I had enjoyed talking with some of the scientists in Atlanta just about how do you make up the experiments for this, because they're really wild. They say this is the most fun of the whole job, inventing experiments to do things with this. And sometimes they'll make up very complex experiments, and then the point of it really doesn't have anything to do with the complexity. It has to do with something else. And this is one of those. Very complex experiment for humans, where you have three-dimensional objects, very odd-shaped three-dimensional objects, and then mentally you're asked to rotate this, say, 160 degrees, and then you have choices of which picture it would look like rotated 160 degrees. These aren't that easy. Now, they had a bunch of people taking this test, and so they had a social hour beforehand when they could all meet and get to know each other and meet all the other people that are going to be in the experiment. But about half of them in the experiment were actually actors. And the purpose of the social hour was just to have some social bonding so that some interpersonal connection could be established. Now, when the test began, the actors would tell the others what the right answers were to these things. And the actors were told to give them the incorrect answers 50% of the time. So here are these people you've just been having cheese, crackers, and drinks with. So, I mean, you know them like brothers and sisters, of course. And they're telling you, oh, that's B, you know, that's B, that's C. Now, the scientists expected some people to follow the wrong answers just because they knew the people. They didn't think it would be 41%. 41% would follow a wrong answer from someone that they trusted. When they had computers give them the wrong answers, they didn't follow the wrong answer anywhere near as often. Then they'd think, but if somebody else likes it, I'll have what she's having. Now, the experiment showed something else, too, that in some ways is even more interesting. And you'll all recognize this one. It's not comforting. And that's the fact that, look, 59% of the people didn't follow the answers they were given. 59% didn't go along with the social pressure they had. But when they were wired up for these things, and they found that their brains, of those 59% of the people, showed great emotional stress. There's a great emotional cost for not going along with the group. So we have pressure to go along because we know what people feel, we know what people want, we want to fit in. A social identity is part of who we are. Not only that, if we stand apart from the group, we feel stressful and we feel bad. And all of you here have done this at some time or another. When you stand for something you think is right and you know you just did it at the cost of not fitting in, I don't care how proud we feel, it still hurts. And that's a deep hurt and a very old hurt. The fact that we learn something from culture, you know, which view of the rotated thing is right, whether the red ball or the white ball is the right enemy, whether it's Bachelor 1 or Bachelor 2, the fact that we're taught something by our culture doesn't mean it's right. It often means it's persuasive, but it doesn't mean it's right. I think one of the most important things to do, and it's hard to do, is to make the distinction between being certain and being right. Being certain just doesn't have anything at all to do with being right, and almost none of us wants to believe it when we're really certain. Okay, I know when I'm certain I'm right, but for the rest of you. But we all tend to feel this way. So I love studies that show things that are cultural, that are learned, that are really neither super good nor super bad, but just super silly. Because we learn them just as avidly and practice them just as well. You may already be thinking of a few. This was an experiment done with monkeys, Japanese macaque monkeys, and a researcher who had worked for 20 years on a mountain overlooking Kyoto told of the curious habit of these Japanese monkeys of rubbing stones together. The monkeys would come down from the mountain to a flat open place where they'd get food from park wardens or visitors. Then every day they collect handfuls of little pebbles and stones. And they carry these to some quiet spot and they rub them or they strike them together or they spread them out in front of them on the ground. They scatter them out, then they gather them up, then they scatter them out, then they gather them up, then they rub them together, and then they make noises, and they'll do this for 3 hours. They've been doing this for generations. They learned it from their parents and their grandparents and their siblings. Here's information passed along from generation to generation through education, not biology. That's a definition of culture. These young monkeys learn this totally useless activity from everyone around them and teach it to the monkeys that follow them. It's amazing. You can think of things in our own culture that might qualify as entertaining but totally useless activities. You can make long lists and you might be surprised how long they are. Watching video games, playing video games, watching television, wearing neckties, the list, wearing high heels. How long is this list? Wearing pantyhose. Where does all this come from? You get the point. But this isn't just monkey business. You can put this in religious perspective, theological perspective, by saying, this isn't just about saying, well, some do this, some do that, some do this. Gosh, we have lots of different behaviors. It isn't about that. It's about saying, wait a minute. What do these behaviors serve? Is there anything they're serving through the behaviors they're doing? Now we're in a religious question. Religions will ask, do our behaviors, to put it in theological language, are we serving gods or are we serving idols? We seem to serve each of them just as well. But in theological understanding, gods are those sorts of centers of values and ideals that can give us a life worth living. If we spend our life serving gods, what's a god? A god can be a sense of compassion, a sense of justice, empathy. These can be gods that rule a life. So can greed, so can power, so can useless activities. And they can be just as persuasive, but when we look back, they haven't given us a life we're glad to have lived. So the question is, what are we serving with these behaviors? More animal stories to show you how different it is and how immediately you see the difference in what behaviors are serving and how you react to them emotionally. These are chimpanzees again. Chimpanzees and bonobos are our closest relatives, and we're their closest relatives. They're more closely related to us than they are to gorillas or orangutans. Chimpanzees. One observation that's been made over and over and over and over again in male chimpanzees is their weapon hunting ability. This is a vicious species. They can be very violent. The violence between males especially can be lethal. Chimps have been observed in the wild catching colobus monkeys, tearing them limb from limb and passing them around for snacks. These are violent monkeys. They've killed one another in violence and they use weapons. And male chimps have been found going where they can't be seen and picking up a whole series of big rocks. They're about 5 times as strong as a young athletic human male. Young chimps have been tested with an arm pull strength of over 1,000 pounds. So they're picking up fairly big rocks that feel right, or big sticks, and they're testing them to see what feels right as a weapon. Then they hide it behind their back, and they go back over where their rival male is, and they use the weapon to attack him, or hurt him, or kill him. This is observed thousands of times. Now, something else, so you have one emotional reaction to that. You can see the picture. Something else that's also been observed over and over, however, is the presence of female chimps who will go up and take the rock out of the male's hand. Female chimps who will disarm the male preparing to fight or kill another male, take the rock or the stick out of their hand. In one observation, they watched a female disarm the same male 6 times in a row. We hear these stories and we react differently to them because they're serving different things. And we react to what they're serving. The story of males seeking weapons to harm or kill other males is a frightening story. And it also hits close to home. We have stories like that. We read about them in the newspaper every day, whether they're gang stories or whether they're stories of armies invading whatever country has the oil or strategic location we want at the time. So we know this kind of behavior, and there's something frightening about it, and there's something familiar about it. But we react differently to the stories of the females. You know, there's an ancient Greek play, the Lysistrata, that a lot of you know, celebrated as sort of the Greek genius in showing how females can stop war. And Lysistrata is a play where females go on a sex strike, and there'll be no sex with warriors until the war stops. Well, it's clever, but it wasn't original. Here's the biological foundation for the notion that females have a sense of peace and stability of the whole group and will trump and disarm the males threatening war. The males are bigger than the females. They could hurt or kill them very easily. There are almost no observations of males ever harming or killing the females who are disarming them. And that's interesting. What it means is the males know, and we seem to believe as we're watching it, the females are serving something of a higher order. If the female chimp tries to steal food from that same male's hand, she may get bit or torn apart. So it isn't just that a female can attack and take whatever they want. But when a female is taking a weapon that a male is preparing to use to hurt or kill another male, they don't retaliate. There's a sense that the female is serving a higher order. The higher order is the peace of the whole group, the good of the many instead of the power of the few. That's very deep. These are animals separated from us by 3 million years or more. All right. I start telling these stories and I just forget what I've written here and tell the stories. The idea of conformity, when the females are taking the weapons away, the males aren't doing it. The males that are just kind of sitting quietly, getting prepared to watch a fight. The females will sometimes take weapons away and join in large choruses of hoots that the males interpret when they get enough females hooting. The males know they have to stop the attack now or they'll be attacked by the females. There are boundaries, there are behavioral boundaries enforced by, in the case of these chimps, females, that everyone in the group realizes. And you hear these stories and say, wait, we understand this. We understand the notion of going too far, of violence that has to be stopped, of the difference between standing alone, and I would imagine the emotional stress of the female is lessened as more females join in and hoot, and the conformity of going along with what the males want and the will to power that they have. This contrast is the same one I'm talking about all morning. Fitting in versus standing for what you think is right. It happens everywhere. And the conflict between conformity and standing up for what you think is right goes on in the sciences just as it goes on in any other field. I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan for 12 years, and so I heard versions of this story for a long time and then just did some fresh research to get some more data. The University of Michigan School is one of the great medical schools. Their medical school is one of the great med schools in the country. It's been there a long time, 150 years or more. Between 1875 and 1922, the medical school changed from teaching homeopathic medicine, herbs and some of the stuff that we now find at homeopathic stores all over town, to teaching allopathic medicine, which is modern medicine in America. As the allopaths gained the strength and the power in the 1910s and 1920s, the homeopathic physicians and their spouses were no longer invited to faculty parties. They were no longer invited to faculty anything. This is fitting in. This is I'll have what she has. It's not about what's right. The allopaths would have seen this as a victory for science and truth. The homeopaths would have seen it as a victory for conformity and suppression. And all over the world, still today, more people have their symptoms relieved from homeopathic medicine than through allopathic medicine. So as different as they are, they obviously each work, at least in the opinions of billions of people who've been treated by them. It isn't about what's right. We are as hardwired as the guppies to notice and care about the tastes of others. And there's a strong urge to conform, to want what they want. This can be the root of almost all evil in history. This is why you had the Nazi spectacle 70 years ago, where the few people did such violence while the overwhelming majority of Germans went along, conformed, didn't want to know, didn't take a stand, and it was very painful to take a stand. You might wind up in a concentration camp or dead. So one answer to why aren't we as empathic and compassionate as some of the stories of other animals we've heard, or the stories of our greatest saints and heroes, is because we're a species that overwhelmingly, overpoweringly wants to fit in. We want to be popular. We want to be accepted. And that can lead to buying a group's lowest common denominator of compassion. And there you've written one of the key themes of human history. Caring what others feel and need is a double-edged sword. That's the roots of our empathy. If we follow the biases of the majority, it will often cut through our own sense of compassion and what we should be doing and let us follow the majority so that we fit in and we don't have such emotional stress. But caring about others, empathy, can also cut through the urge to conform and let us be guided by our nobler nature, like the female chimps disarming the males, like the student in Tiananmen Square standing in front of the tank, that photo that you'll never forget once you've seen it. I mean, here's the photo of what can happen to someone who stands up. You can get not only emotionally stressed, but crushed flat. And yet that photo of one person standing up for what was right is one of the most powerful images, I'm suggesting, to anyone who's seen it, anyone who's heard it. So what do? We know better, but we don't always do better. We're born a mixture of good and evil, selfish and selfless, courageous and cowardly. Or we could ignore both paths of good and evil and just spend our time doing entertaining but useless things, like rubbing stones together or playing video games, or your own favorite list of useless things. But almost every religion and philosophy has always said that the better life will be lived if we seek the light, if we seek the path of more compassion. Abraham Lincoln used to say that we need to listen to the better angels of our nature rather than the worse angels of our nature, because they're both there talking, as you know. He's saying, listen to the inner voices counseling disarmament, justice, empathy, compassion, love. Don't listen to the louder voices. Don't follow the crowd. There's an old story about wolves that says all this at least as well. This isn't a story about real wolves. This is a story about story wolves. In one version, it's a Native American story. In one version, an Indian boy went to his grandfather for advice. This boy was big for his age and stronger than all of his friends. And he was having trouble. And he said, Grandfather, sometimes I just want to use my strength to take whatever I want that others have because I can do it and I can get away with it. And nobody can stop me. And I want to do that. And sometimes I do it, Grandfather. But sometimes, he said, it feels like I should be using my strength to help the weaker people, to help people from being beat up and to help have sort of more just laws. And he said, sometimes I feel that way, though not as often. Not as often. And he said, I don't know whether I'm a bad person or what, but he said, I wonder, Grandfather, if you have wisdom. And the grandfather says, oh, yes. He said, I know those feelings very well from my own life. He said, it's like having two wolves fighting within me. One wolf says, fight, hurt, take. The other wolf says, help, care, love. These wolves are fighting against each other always, as far back as I can remember, he said. They're inside of me fighting to control me. And the boy said, yes, that's exactly what's going on. That's just what's like. But he said, you didn't tell me the last part, grandfather. He said, which wolf wins? And his grandfather puts his arm around his grandson, and he said, the wolf that I feed, my beloved boy, the wolf that I feed. And so it is with us.